Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome you all for our third argument in this March calendar, and we have some special guests. We have students from Hamilton High School. Would they please stand? Mm-hmm. We're delighted to have you. You may be seated. I believe that you all attended the noon session. Justice Bradley, and at noon, the students discussed with Justice Bradley the procedures of the court for taking a case and deciding cases, but not the substantive issue of the cases that we're hearing today. The students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar and this court, called Court with Class. They're invited to come, they attend an oral argument, they get materials about the case, they may do some extracurricular activities with the case, and then they appear for an oral argument. We also have some special guests, and they are the Senate Scholars. Are they in the courtroom? Would they stand, please? Thank you. You may be seated. The Senate Scholars come from all around the state, and they are here with us for a week. When I say us, especially the state Senate, but they're interested in all the activities of state government. And they were here Sunday night in the courtroom, and I found them by surprise. And when the courthouse was closed, and then invited them, so I'm delighted to see you all here. Thank you for coming. I hope your week is going well. And on Friday, I'm told you're going to meet with a justice, and it's going to be Justice Crooks that you will meet with. I don't know if the students got a copy of the summary of the case they're about to hear. You're nodding yes. Okay, that's fine. Anyone else like a summary of the case you're about to hear? If so, would you raise your hand? All right. The next order of business then is for me to introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Some of you have met her earlier. And to her right is Justice David Prosser. And to his right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. And to my immediate left is Justice Crooks.
Well done.
Now that we've made all these introductions, have I done something wrong yet? No, not yet. With these introductions made, I'll now call the next case, 08-AP-2937, Mercy Care Insurance Company versus Wisconsin Commissioner of Insurance. Arguing on behalf of the Wisconsin Commissioner of Insurance is Bruce A. Olson, Assistant Attorney General. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Bruce Olson. I represent the Commissioner of Insurance. Pregnancy is a medical condition that requires medical care and treatment to protect the health of pregnant women and the unborn child that she is carrying. That treatment is medically necessary, whether the pregnancy is planned or unplanned, whether the woman intends to parent the child or give it to others to parent, and whether the woman has or doesn't have a genetic relationship to the child that she's carrying. Employees of companies that provide group health insurance purchase insurance with maternity coverage to protect against the risk of unpaid medically necessary care and treatment if they, their dependent spouses, and or their dependent daughters become pregnant. Insurers promise to pay the medically necessary costs of pregnancy and delivery in exchange for receiving premiums calculated to cover the cost, the expected costs of maternity coverage for the insured group. In this case, two women insured by Mercy Care paid their premiums, expecting medical coverage. Mercy Care accepted those premiums but did not cover their medically necessary pregnancy care on the ground that the policy excluded coverage for surrogate mother services. One of the women, C.S., complained to the Commissioner of Insurance. In December 2006, the Commissioner issued a final decision and order preventing Mercy Care from enforcing its pregnancy and reproductive service benefit exclusions in a 2002 certificate of insurance and a 2005 group insurance certificate, both on the grounds that they excluded surrogate mother services.
Counselor,
yes.
Just so I'm clear on the facts, neither of the women who are at issue here were under the 2005 policy. Both of them were under the 2002 policy, correct?
That's correct.
So no one is making a claim before us for benefits under the 2005 policy.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
That's correct. The insurance commissioner disapproved the use of that 2005 form.
Let me make sure I understand the procedural posture then. The insurance commissioner disapproved the 2005 form, and Mercy Care contested that. It went before an administrative law judge. The issue was also before the circuit court judge, and the circuit court judge ordered the commissioner to approve the 2005 form. Is that correct?
Mostly correct.
Okay.
Just the early piece is not quite correct.
Help me get it straight then.
The CS complained to the Commissioner of Insurance, and during the investigation of her complaint, denial of coverage under the 2002 certificate, Mercy Care amended its certificate and submitted the 2005 version. That 2005 was disapproved, and then kind of both issues went to the administrative law judge, eventually the commissioner, on basically a summary disposition mm-hmm. kind of basis. So there was both the use of the 2002 certificate and the denial of the 2005 certificate.
If I may then fast forward to the circuit court. The circuit court ordered the commissioner to approve the 2005 form, and the commission appealed that issue along with the other issue of the 2002 to the Court of Appeals.
That's
correct.
Correct? Right. Yes. Okay. The commissioner's decision disapproved the use of the forms on a couple of different grounds. One was that the language of the forms themselves, both the 2002 and the 2005 forms, were ambiguous, vague, unduly verbose, and complex. The other ground was that the mandatory maternity benefits coverage statute, Section 8, or 632.895 sub 7, prevents insurers from creating subclasses of its insureds who are offered differential and lesser benefits than other subgroups of its insureds. In the circuit court, Judge Welker decided that the statute permitted the kinds of the creation of two different classes of insureds. And so he took the view that because he reached that decision that the statute allowed what Mercy Care was doing, that he didn't need to reach the question about policy, the adequacy of the policy language. My plan is to first address the question of the policy language, because I think the case can be disposed of on that ground alone. Second, to address the statutory interpretation question, whether the statute permits what Mercy Care has done. And third, to address the question of the court's standards of review and the deference, if any, that should be afforded to the commissioner's interpretation, that alternate ground of decision. 2002 certificate has a as a series of sections, and they basically are broken down into a general description of a risk, for example, pregnancy benefits or reproductive services. And then underneath that, the form lists covered services and lists non-covered services. Under covered services, the certificate tells insureds that treatment of pregnancy is covered for an employee's covered dependent spouse, or an employee's covered dependent child, and informs insureds that pregnancy benefits include coverage for inpatient hospital care and pre- and postnatal care received from a participating provider. The form lists non-covered services. Some of them are kind of specific kinds of exceptions, amniocentesis solely for the purpose of sex determination, elective abortions, maternity services received outside the service area within the last 30 days of pregnancy without prior authorization. And then the certificate excludes or defines as a non-covered service surrogate mother services. That term is not defined in the 2002 certificate. In interpreting insurance policies, the court addresses it from the viewpoint of what would a reasonably informed insured understand the policy to mean. If there is ambiguity, that the policy needs to be construed strictly against the insurer who picked the language. An insured woman who is reading a certificate the commissioner submits would see that the treatment of her pregnancy, specifically including hospital stays, prenatal care, postnatal care, was covered. She would read the exclusions in this context. She would see in the exclusions a list of specific non-covered medical procedures that Mercy Care would not pay for any insured. Elective abortion, maternity services outside the area late in pregnancy, amniocentesis for the sole purpose of determining sex, and would look at surrogate mother services as one of those kinds of excluded non-covered services.
Counselor, I understand from your brief, your argument is that if they're going to cover maternity benefits, then it shouldn't matter how the woman became pregnant, whether it was through a process where there was medical assistance in that or not, because there's a subgroup created which you tell us is not proper to do. If I look at amniocentesis, there's no restriction on it except if you just want to use it to learn the sex of your unborn child. Doesn't that put a separate out a group right there? You seem to think that's okay, but you know, you can get amniocentesis done, but apparently they won't pay if it's done for sex determination.
Yes, and that
why isn't that a subgroup?
That is a specific and limited medical service that that applies exactly the same to all insureds, so that every insured who wants to use amniocentesis solely for the purpose of determining the sex of their child has that procedure not covered by insurance. That's a different kind of a grouping than is an exclusion that says some people get all of their prenatal care, their doctor's visits, their laboratory tests, their heart checks and such covered, and then some group gets none of them checks, gets none of those services covered. I think it's a difference between the kinds of groupings that are created by the statute
Could this policy say, we're going to provide maternity coverage, but only babies 1 through 3? You have your fourth baby, you're on your own. Could they do that?
I don't think that could be resolved strictly by looking at the policy language. I mean, I think that has to do with the interpretation of the statute. The insurance commissioner, I think, would say, no, you can't do that. That is that is creating separate classes of insureds, subgroups of insureds, and women who have exactly the same risk, pregnancy, and all of the medical conditions that are incident to it, some of those women are covered, namely those women who are having babies 1 through 3, and some are not, namely those who are having 4 through N.
So you think that would be a prohibited class rather than a restriction on services?
I think it would be, yes.
Okay, thank you.
But it doesn't come under 7 if you're dealing with the child. 7, subsection 7 only deals with maternity coverage.
My understanding was that, Your Honor, was that the question was about maternity coverage for the pregnant woman and not
on
for...
the fourth child. Okay, right. Got it.
We should say fourth pregnancy rather than fourth child, I suppose, to be more clear.
Counsel, in some ways, analytically, I don't know what the answers necessarily are, but analytically, this is an easy case, and in some ways, it's a difficult case. Let me tell you why I think it's difficult. Because we have incoming traffic patterns, right? One way to resolve cases that we're all familiar with is look at the language in insurance context, look at the language of the policy. If the provision is ambiguous, it's construed in favor of coverage, end of story. That's one way that we analyze cases and get to a conclusion. Another way we analyze cases and get to a conclusion is, what's the level? We've got an administrative agency. What's the level of deference? And, for instance, if it would be something like great weight deference, if that's the answer, then we may get to the end of the story right there by that framework of analysis. Another thing we have going on here to get to the end of the story is I don't care who says what in terms of interpretation, we look at the statute, we look at the policy, and see if the policy is violative of the language of the statute. End of story. So we have three analytical frameworks converging here. We also have a 2002 policy, which apparently two women were claiming under, but they weren't claiming under a 2005 policy. So that leaves room for analysis for 2002, getting to the end of the story, a disposition, being different than our 2005. Am I correct in these different approaches here, or am I finding this too complex?
I think there are alternative grounds that the court can reach a decision. And the probably the narrowest and simplest is to look at the language to say, we don't know, we don't have to decide whether the statute permits the creation of classes of subgroups of insureds. We can just look at the certificate language that was used in 2002 and 2005 and ask ourselves, would a reasonable insured reading that know whether their pregnancy benefits were going to be excluded?
Can we do that? Arguably, that framework of analysis works for the 2002. You have two claimants under the policy. Can you do that under the 2005 also? Does ambiguity is construed in, usually we say ambiguity is construed in favor of the insured or in favor of coverage. We use those terms kind of interchangeably in our opinions. But of course, here there is no insured claimant for 2005. That arose out of a little different procedure. That is approval of the form as opposed to being subjected by to a claim by insurance.
It's true that there is no individual who has been adversely affected by the 2005 certificate, but as you point out correctly, 631.20 requires insurance forms to be submitted to the insurance commissioner before they are used must be approved before they can be used. The commissioner is given authority under that statute to disapprove forms. As a result, I think there are still two adverse parties here. It's not an individual, but it is the insurance commissioner and Mercy Care, who would like to use that certificate, that 2005 certificate, and the insurance commissioner has said no, that the definition of surrogate mother in that certificate is hopelessly vague and verbose. I think you can decide the 2005 certificate question on the same ground as you decide the 2002 certificate question, and that is whether there's ambiguity in those policy forms, regardless whether the statute would permit or would deny a properly crafted surrogate mother services exception.
What's the ambiguity then in the language surrogate mother services in the 2002 contract?
Well, you don't know what it means. I think if you look at the other non-covered services, they are specific medical procedures that are disallowed. So a woman who is reading this might think, oh, surrogate mother services, that must mean something, a medical service that is kind of peculiar to the circumstance of women who are pregnant as a result of acting as surrogate mothers. The court has said that you can look to dictionary definitions to assist you in that, and a woman who might look at a dictionary definition, the one that Mercy Care suggests, would see that surrogate mother is defined as a woman who becomes pregnant, usually by artificial insemination or surgical implantation of a fertilized egg for the purpose of carrying the fetus to term for another woman. Well, the definition has two women involved in it and identifies some specific services that an insured might kind of latch on to and decide, oh, I see what surrogate mother services is. It is artificial insemination or surgical implantation. Those are the things that distinguish me from any other pregnant insured. And so the policy must be excluding those things. She would be aided, I think, in that interpretation by looking at the reproductive services portion of the policy, which excludes many kinds of procedures for to achieve pregnancy, artificial means to achieve pregnancy. And limits artificial insemination benefits to the physician's charges. It excludes other things like donor sperm, a common factor in surrogate mother pregnancies, charges for donor fees,
What did OCI think that meant? What did OCI think that surrogate mother services meant when it approved the 2002 contract?
Thought that the exclusion meant that Mercy Care would not cover the medical services required by a non-insured pregnant woman who was carrying a pregnancy for an insured.
That would have been an unusual interpretation, wouldn't it, since every benefit that's under an insurance contract is for an insured.
Well, in a sense, I mean, for an insured, I mean, you know, that's where the principle of surrogacy comes in a sense, you know, on behalf of, I suppose, might be one way of looking at it. But if your question is, wouldn't it be really odd to exclude medical services for someone who isn't covered anyway?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, usually an exclusion is it's someone who's covered, and then you take that person out of the mix, and with a third party that is not a named insured under the policy. That'd be like my health insurance policy for my husband and myself, including someone that lives halfway down the block. I mean, they're not in there to begin with, so you don't need to exclude them later.
That was an argument.
Yes,
I understand what you mean. That was an argument that was made by Mercy Care, and the insurance commissioner pointed out that insurance policies frequently have exclusions for people who are not covered, just as a way of emphasis on policy terms. In fact, Mercy Care's own 2002 certificate excludes services for non-insureds. For example, let's take the sperm donor piece. Mercy Care's reproductive services policy term excludes reimbursement for donor sperm. Well, that the donor sperm is a non-covered individual. Why would it be excluded if it is?
Well, you could look at it like a medicine. You know, if you were looking at it as part of the procedures of getting pregnant, usually there's a lot of hormone therapy that goes on with surrogacy too, and you know, the sperm is part of that whole package if you're using the egg of the mother. But anyway, I understand.
There are certainly other exclusions in Mercy Care's policy that apply to non-insureds.
Counsel,
these are donors, organ transplant donors, blood donors who aren't insured.
Right.
They're all in the brief.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm looking at Appendix 118, and it explains it this way. OCI believed the provision in Mercy Care's 2002 certificate was intended to exclude the expenses that were incurred by an insured, so in other words, incurred by the first party to the contract, for the services of a third person who's acting as a surrogate or gestational carrier on behalf of the insured. So at least, and according to the affidavit of Dambach, and this is part of the findings of the commissioner, the final decision in the Office of Commissioner of Insurance, that's that if the first party to the contract, the named insured, incurred expenses for the services of the third party who's acting as a surrogate. That's what they thought was being excluded. I'm not sure they're right or wrong, but this is the way that it's explained anyway.
Yes.
Who do we have here?
I'm sorry, pardon me?
Who is the insured here?
Under these policies, the insureds are CS and JM, the employees.
Yeah, and they're the pregnant women.
The pregnant women, yes.
So it doesn't fit into what Justice Bradley just read. In other words, Mercy Care's 2000 certificate was intended to exclude the expenses incurred by an insured who's not here.
By an insured for the surrogacy of me, of
right.
Third party.
But the third party surrogate is the insured in this case.
Yes, in this case, the third party,
the insured
is the one who's serving as surrogate. She is an employee, a spouse or a daughter, in this case, employee and dependent child, who are covered for their pregnancies, for all of their pregnancies except if they are carrying a child for another person.
So with someone who is pregnant but going to give a baby up for adoption, would they be considered a surrogate?
It depends, I think, on which certificate you are looking at. Under the 2002, I think it still is uncertain, though a dictionary definition would suggest not, because they aren't really didn't become pregnant for the purpose of carrying a child for another person, typically. Under the 2005 certificate, it's much more challenging to sort out because of the definition that includes, defines as someone who is a surrogate, someone who may or may not have a genetic relationship to the child. That pretty much covers the universe of pregnant women who are carrying children. They either do or do not have a genetic relationship to their children. And if The third phrase of that 2005 definition applies, parented by another. I think a kind of conventionally pregnant woman who gives up her genetically related child for adoption would be considered a surrogate mother under Mercy Care's 2005 policy.
Thank you.
I see that the red light is on. If there are no further questions, I will sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Dushman, representing Mercy Care Insurance Company.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. My name is Matt Dushman, and I do represent Mercy Care Insurance Company and Mercy Care HMO, who I'll call together Mercy Care today. Seated with me at council table is Attorney Ralph Topinka, Mercy Care's general counsel. Your Honors, I have a little different take on this case. I think this case is really about the fundamental power of this court to declare what the law is. And the commissioner's position is really telling this court that in this circumstance, the court should have no practical role in interpreting an insurance law. Basically, if it involves insurance, keep out. And in addition to telling the court that, the commissioner is also trying to rewrite the statute at issue to apply an insurance mandate that doesn't otherwise exist. And so with that in mind, there are really three issues that I'd like to discuss in basically reverse order from my opposing counsel, and that is, number one, the level of deference that's afforded to an agency decision, which I think needs to be decided prior to looking to the second issue that I'd like to talk about, which is the meaning of Section 632.895 sub 7 in this case. And then finally, depending upon the court's interpretation of that particular statute, whether or not Mercy Care's insurance contract language complies with the statute and permits or properly covers the exclusion of expenses incurred by women acting as surrogate mothers. So,
is your third issue, does the contract conform with the statute? Is that, what's your third issue?
Yes, Your Honor. The third issue is, does the language in the 2002 and 2005 certificates, do they comply with the statute?
And you don't have an issue with regard to ambiguity, is that right?
Well, I suppose I don't think so. I read the language in the 2002 certificate as being what it says, surrogate mother services, and I've defined that in the brief. We do acknowledge with respect to the 2005 certificate that there's a comma missing. I think I put that in the brief, that there really ought to be a comma added after donor to make sure that that last clause of the definition of surrogate mother applies. So we acknowledge some problems with drafting there, but to the extent the court finds the 2002 certificate in compliance with the statute, we really don't need to reach the 2005 certificate at all, because that if the 2002 is good enough, then we know it's good enough.
Well, the 2005 isn't going to have any bearing on the claims of the surrogate mother anyway. Now, I was kind of wondering when I read your brief, because you both spent a fair amount of time on that 2005 certificate, if it didn't pass muster with the commissioner, why don't you just go back and talk to him and say, you know, what's unclear and revise it? I mean, that's lawyer work. That's not really court work.
That's a very good question, Your Honor, and I think it's the reason why I would say that we really should address the statutory interpretation question here today. Because if we have to go back to the commissioner's office, I think it's become clear that we're just going to be back here 6 years from now, like we were in 2004 or 2005, debating whether or not you can even have an exclusion that excludes expenses incurred for surrogate mothers.
I agree with that. I think the statute is very important. So let's hear what you think.
Great. I was going to cover deference first. I guess big picture speaking, as far as deference, I think it's important to start with just the proposition that the interpretation and application of a statute, as has been recognized by this court, is an issue of law, particularly in a case like this where there are undisputed facts. The facts, in fact, were stipulated, too. So starting with that premise, we have the sliding scale of three levels of deference to assist the court in determining when it's an appropriate policy to defer to an agency decision. We're not quarreling with the current status of those three levels, great weight, due weight, and no weight. We think they should apply, and they should continue to apply. There's really two points that I'd like to make as far as deference. Number one, this is a case of first impression, clearly. Therefore, the court should afford no weight or should apply de novo review to the insurance commissioner's interpretation in this case. And then the second point is that the commissioner relies upon this notion of a statutory scheme, and that if the commissioner is at all responsible for administering a statutory scheme and that the statute falls within that scheme, it ought to automatically be entitled to great weight deference. So as far as first impression, there's nothing in the record that provides an interpretation of the statute. No rule, no policy, no decision, no order, no case, no writing. The only thing we have, as was referred to by opposing counsel earlier, is Ms. Dombach's affidavit and Ms. Dombach's testimony in her deposition. But it's important to note that testimony recognizes that she had an opinion about the first sentence of 632.895 sub 7, which just says that if you're going to provide insurance coverage in a disability policy, you have to provide it to all the covered persons. She had an opinion about that, but as it respects the important exclusion language in the second sentence, she testified that she had an opinion, but she didn't share it with anyone. So to suggest that the commissioner's office had an understanding or had previously interpreted or applied the exclusion language that's important to this case, I think is not accurate. There has been no prior interpretation or application of the statute. This is the first case. For that reason alone, applying the three levels of deferential review would call for this court to allow no deference to the commissioner. On the issue of the statutory scheme, there is some language that appears to have its origin in the Barron Electric case from the Court of Appeals that suggests it would be appropriate for a state agency to be given great weight deference merely in the instance where that agency is responsible for administering a statutory scheme and the statute at issue falls within that. I submit that would be bad policy, and that's not supported by the Barron Electric by the reasoning in the cases cited in Barron Electric. Really what it would mean is that if the governor signs a bill into law on day one, that same day a statute would be practically and solely within the purview of a state agency, and the court would immediately need to defer to that state agency's interpretation of the statute. And at its heart, as I said, this case is about the power of the court. I don't think that is a good policy to have, that before a law is even interpreted or applied in any way, we're already deferring to an unelected state agency to determine what the policy and meaning of that law is. In addition, I think that theory would swallow the current framework of the deferential review analysis. The theory is essentially based on the notion that the agency has the responsibility for administering the scheme. If you look to the great weight deference test, there are four factors. The first factor is whether or not the agency has responsibility for administering the statutory scheme. So that issue is already built into the deferential review sliding scale test. The court already will consider that as part of the one of four factors in determining whether or not great weight should be afforded.
Counsel, let's assume for a minute that the court decides that great weight deference is not appropriate here. Do you think the result is going to be any different whether we apply due weight deference or de novo, or do we come to the same conclusions?
Yeah, I think you'll come to the same conclusion, Your Honor, for two reasons.
Yeah, you're right there.
You bet. The first is that I think that the commissioner's interpretation in this case is not reasonable and it conflicts with the language of the statute. And regardless of what level of deference is applied, even great weight, in that instance, I think the court should reject that interpretation. But for another reason as well, and really it's one that we've seen in some of the cases, and that is there really is no practical difference between due weight and de novo review, because the court is going to choose whatever it deems the most reasonable interpretation.
In de novo, you just say the court just determines what's reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor.
In due weight, the court says, well, this is what they say is reasonable, but we don't agree, in effect. So, and in fact, in all three, the court has to determine what's reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's right.
So why are we fussing?
Well, I think we're fussing because the way the law is developed based upon Barron Electric is unclear. We do have this sort of conflict about statutory scheme.
Well, where is it unclear? Is it unclear in the Supreme Court cases? Is it unclear in the Court of Appeals cases? Is it unclear in both?
Well, I think what's unclear, and I do, I have seen the language in the Clean Wisconsin case that of this court, and I believe in preparing for today, I also saw it in the Hilton decision, and that's the statement that when the agency is responsible for administering the statutory scheme, you provide great weight deference. That statement in isolation seemed to have developed from Barron Electric, which is a Court of Appeals case. And Barron Electric, in my brief, I traced it back through the other decisions it looked at. So those are the cases I'm talking about. And I think what's unclear is that litigants are starting to take, as the commissioner does in this case, with the National Motorist decision, which is also based on Barron Electric, are starting to take that statement in isolation and try and use it as an argument for affording great weight deference to agencies without going through the traditional sliding scale analysis.
Okay. In almost all the cases, if not all, if the agency is doing something, it has a responsibility under the statute by definition. No?
Yes, if the agency is acting, has a responsibility.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that, you can make something special out of that provision, depending on whether the agency is a line agency making rules and regulations, maybe, or whether it's an agency that deals with contested cases, right?
Right.
So it's not just that the agency is going to be responsible, because by definition, the agency is responsible, otherwise we wouldn't be here. So you need something else. Now, sometimes the agency has cases or right on the point of a surrogate mother, right? It doesn't here.
It doesn't in this case, but other cases, sure. Yeah, there are.
And to the extent you have a line of cases for surrogate mother and they're consistent, you'd probably give great weight. You agree with that?
I agree. If it's longstanding and consistent and meets the other factors right. For great weight, yes.
So you have a case that doesn't have a long line. In fact, they have no line of defining surrogate. But the Commissioner of Insurance has defined other terms in policies and has defined mandatory coverage, which is the statute we're talking about, right?
Correct, 632.895 sub 7 only.
And this is 7, but they've got a lot of experience interpreting this whole provision, but not specifically this subsection. And they've got a lot more experience than the court does, any court. Right?
Yes.
Okay. And the kicker what deference you give is when you clear out all the brushes is an institutional one. Court has said a number of times, really the test is what institution is better able to make this decision for uniformity, right, consistency, et cetera.
For great weight, yes, those are.
Or even to give it any deference, you'd have to get to this kind of concept. So. If they've had a lot of interpretation experience in the insurance area and in defining contracts, right, and approving contracts, don't you think the court, but they haven't had any experience in surrogate mother, don't you think the court should bow a little to them?
If it's a brand new law that has never been interpreted before, no, I don't. I think that the question really is what did the legislature intend as far as who was going to control the interpretation
of policy? That's always the question, although it's stated more specifically as to what statutory language means. But when you've got the commissioner already interpreting mandatory coverage in other aspects, you'd ignore all that?
Well, assuming that I wouldn't ignore it if the other provisions were comparable enough such that you're basically interpreting the same law, the same provisions. I think that with this particular subsection, sub 7 of that statute, there's no indication, there certainly isn't any indication in the record of this case that the insurance commissioner has any greater expertise than a court as far as interpreting that language. That was admitted by the insurance commissioner's counsel at oral argument before the trial court, that the court would be in as good or a better position to interpret the language of the statute. So in this part, at least as it respects the facts of this case, we have a new law that has not been interpreted. So, and we're not dealing with a situation where a law has been interpreted and is being applied to new facts. That doesn't, that's outside the scope here. So a new law, this law hasn't been interpreted, and the commissioner is acknowledging that it has no greater experience than or ability to interpret the law than the court. Under those facts, I think every time the court should say this is our fundamental responsibility as elected officials to say what the law is, and not cede that power, that responsibility to an unelected official.
Counselor, as I read the statutes, and I am most interested in the second sentence of subsection 7, because I too find that the most difficult to deal with. To me, the first sentence seems to be people-focused. You're going to give maternity provisions, you give maternity provisions to pregnant women. The second one seems to be that it is more service focused. At least that's the argument I think that has been made. And my question to you is the same as to your opposing counsel. Under that second sentence, could Mercy Care say, we are providing coverage for pregnancies 1 through 3, but any of you women who get pregnant with number 4, you're on your own? Can they do that? Will that fit under the second sentence?
Yes, I think they could.
Why?
Because that exclusion would apply uniformly to every single person under the policy. Any dependent, any spouse, or any covered employee would know going in that if they got pregnant a fourth time, that coverage would be excluded.
But they also exclude certain types of pregnancies that may end up in very high-risk pregnancies for the woman. For example, there have been things written about women having children in their mid-50s, and that's done through a lot of support of hormones and a variety of other things. And it can be very expensive because you could have a woman in the hospital in bed for 7 months out of the 9 months. Could they exclude that kind of maternity coverage under subsection, the second sentence in subsection 7?
I don't think there's anything in subsection 7 that would necessarily prohibit that, but I would be concerned about running afoul of some other laws, possibly discrimination laws in the state of Wisconsin, and also I suspect that just general competition, might be a bad policy for an insurance company to...
I'm just trying to figure out, really, the breadth of the second sentence. That's my biggest problem with this case.
Right, and the way I look at it, Your Honor, is just it requires uniformity. And when you look at the language of an exclusion as it exists in a policy, the question is, does that exclusion apply to all covered persons equally? And I submit that it does in this case.
Isn't it just a matter of lens? In other words, which lens are you looking through? Are you looking at providing this? Are you looking at paying for prenatal delivery and postnatal care? Given the example of Justice Grogensack, if I were having a fourth child, I'd say, hey, you're excluding me as a person. That is, Jane is pregnant. She's covered. You pay all of her expenses. Mary's pregnant. You pay all of her pre, post, and delivery expenses. You're not paying my expenses. And so you're not treating all of your insureds the same because you cover, it says, pregnancy expenses. And so you're not covering all the same. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. If I were the named insured, I'd look at it that way. If I were the insurance company, I'd probably say, oh, no. We are applying to all this group of pregnant women a rule that says, 3 times you're in, 4th time you're out in terms of coverage. And so we're applying it equally. So it's just a matter of how you're looking at the very same thing. One way, if you look at it, it's just a matter of, oh, we're excluding the service. We don't cover this service, the 4th delivery in pregnancy.
The other group is going to say, oh, no, you should treat all pregnant women alike. And now you're treating named insureds differently, people differently. That's the way I see it. I think the people here are talking with different lenses for the same issue.
I agree, and I think that the point I would make in response is that the statute doesn't require the insurance company who's drafting a policy to use one lens or the other. And it really goes to the issue of the breadth of the...
But you can't... I think the statute... I thought there was consensus that it can't discriminate against people. It can't discriminate against insureds. It can't have subcategories of insured people. Isn't that right?
I don't think there's a consensus on that because the reason I would say that is because I think that any exclusion by its very nature has to discriminate.
Well, that gets this whole lens thing.
It's going to discriminate not just based on services but on people as well. I mean, any exclusion by its definition will only apply to those people who are getting the service. And we talked earlier about the in vitro fertilization the amniocentesis for the purpose of discerning gender. I mean, if you look at the exclusion as it exists, that applies to every covered person under the policy. So then we have the risk event. The person becomes pregnant. The person wants amniocentesis to determine gender. That person has services excluded. However, the person who needs amniocentesis for some other reason, that person gets coverage. There's no dispute that exclusion is permitted here, and that really isn't any different in the sense of a surrogate mother. So you take the language as it exists now, and it applies to all covered persons. We have an event, a risk that happens. Somebody becomes pregnant. If somebody has become pregnant because they've decided that they want to benefit a third party who's not an insured under the policy, then that event is not covered. And really that's consistent here with the whole notion of personal health insurance coverage. The very need to have group disability insurance is to protect and cover the risks of the members themselves.
How does this work? Because one of the things that bothers me, if you could address it, because it bothers me, and that is your 2005 contract. 2002, you didn't define surrogate mother. In your 2005, you do define surrogate mother. And surrogate mothers then are services are excluded. And in 2005, the definition of surrogate mother reads, surrogate mother means a woman who, through in vitro fertilization or any other means of fertilization, gives birth to a child which she may or may not have had a genetic relationship to. So here I am, worked for the company for several years, get married, my husband gets in an auto accident and has a spinal cord injury. We want to have a child. The only way to have a child is through in vitro fertilization. Boy, I would think that I would have the expectation as your employee and as the mother of the child and the wife of the husband who has a spinal cord injury, who can't therefore we can't have a baby through normal intercourse, I would expect to be covered. But you're saying no. Just something problematic about that. So help me through that. Why shouldn't I be bothered by that?
Well, because we're not saying no. In your circumstance, you would be covered, Your Honor. And the reason is that there's a comma missing after the word donor. And that would mean that the last clause, when the child will be parented by someone other than the woman who gives birth, would apply to both of the prior description of the means of becoming pregnant. So the key, as far as surrogacy goes, is that the purpose of the pregnancy is to give birth to a child that will be parented by someone other than the woman who gives birth. So in your scenario where...
Remind me where you're putting this paragraph,
sure.
This comma rather. Surrogate mother means a woman who, through in vitro fertilization or any other means of fertilization, gives birth to a child which she may or may not have a genetic relationship to, or an individual, just feel free to stop, or an individual who provides a uterus for the gestation of a fertilized ovum,
obtained from a donor,
comma. That means that those prior two descriptions of defining a person are both modified by the last clause. When the child will be parented by someone other than the woman whom gives birth.
So you're wrong. This goes to the woman who gives the egg? Is that the one that's excluded?
The person who would be excluded would be the covered and the insured employee, spouse, or dependent who actually becomes pregnant, regardless of how that person became pregnant, except that if the pregnancy was for the purpose of giving that child to some other non-covered.
That's the way we've been reading it. Isn't that the way you've been reading it? If Justice Bradley is covered by your insurance policy as an insured, and she gets pregnant through in vitro fertilization, is she covered or not?
She's covered if she intends to keep the child at the time that she becomes pregnant.
What if it's my sister and I get pregnant through in vitro fertilization because my sister isn't able to carry the child? I have a genetic relationship with the child under the terms of the policy. Then what?
Assuming your sister's not covered under the same policy, and your intention at the time was to be a surrogate mother, then your expenses would not be covered.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a question on subsection 7? The first sentence of that subsection, does that cover all women who are covered by the policy?
Yes, I believe it could. Every potential woman, either as employee, spouse of employee, or dependent of employee.
So that sentence, it seems to me, couldn't be much broader.
Yes, Your Honor, it's very broad. If you offer maternity coverage to anyone under the policy, it has to be offered to all women who are covered under the policy.
Now, does the second sentence authorize exclusions?
In my opinion, it does, yes.
And what's the limit on the authorization?
I believe the limit is uniformity. When you look at the language of that exclusion, it has to apply equally to all of the people that were described above. And the reason is, if you trace back through the legislative history and look at the change that was made, you'll see that as it was originally enacted in 1981, it required that coverage be provided for dependent children, but it left out spouses of employees. And so when it was changed in 1985, it was changed to make clear that not only would dependent children get the coverage if an employee does, but that employee's spouse would also get the coverage. So the purpose of the change and the current language is to make sure that everyone's treated uniformly.
I have a question for you. If I wanted to buy surrogate mother coverage because I knew I was going to be a surrogate mother and I came to Mercy Care, what policy would you give me? What policy would I need to buy?
Right. I don't believe that Mercy Care offers any independent policy that is designed to cover pregnancy by a surrogate mother, but I do believe, and this is not in the record, but I do believe that there are policies out there that can be purchased.
Can you answer a second question for me? In that definition where it says in vitro fertilization, most people have an idea of what that might encompass, but what does the phrase any other means of fertilization mean?
I don't know.
Seems fairly broad, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is broad.
So if you become pregnant, isn't that what it says, regardless of
it
how?
Does. And that's
and whether it's genetic or not.
Right, and that covers traditional surrogacy versus gestational surrogacy, basically bringing us back to the point, which is, was the person intending on being the parent or providing the child to intend
it? It has to be at the time of the fertilization?
At the time of the pregnancy, which I would interpret as the time of the fertilization.
Okay, so if I, at the time I become, moment I become pregnant, plan on keeping the baby, but sometime during the pregnancy decide to give it up for adoption or otherwise, I'd be covered.
I believe you would. I don't believe that that would fall within the definition of surrogate mother, as we're arguing.
Well, then,
could I go back to the statute a minute? Justice Rogensack, I believe it was, asked you the question about fourth child. If you say that that the second sentence authorizes exclusions and the test is uniformity, it could really be second child.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
I mean, I'm troubled that you're interpreting this sentence to really virtually gut the sweeping nature of the first sentence. Could it say to all unmarried mothers?
I don't think it could say for unmarried mothers. I don't think there's anything necessary in this language of this statute that provides it, but I do believe that would run afoul of the state's discrimination laws, which says that you can't discriminate against on the basis of marital status. So I think that there's a separate law that exists to protect against that.
But if there, suppose there were not that separate outside statute that puts a gloss on this, if it were just a matter of interpreting subsection 7, Could you exclude an entire group that way?
I think that the language of the statute is broad, Your Honor, and it would allow it. And that would bring me back to, if the policy needs to change, it's a policy the legislature should change, and not the commissioner's office here. And I see my red lights on. I had planned on offering just a summary of the relief that we're requesting in the case. If you'd like,
may I may just ask you a question? So if I If the pregnancy is through intercourse, but that I feel my task in life is to have children and then offer them to other people who cannot have children, so I have no intention of taking care of this child, am I covered by the policy or not?
No, Your Honor. That hypothetical would not be covered because it would fall within the definition of surrogate mother, as we've set forth as far as the interpretation of the policy language. A woman who becomes pregnant for carrying a fetus to term for the benefit of another. And I think the reason, again, goes back to the whole purpose for personal health insurance coverage here, which is that it's intended to benefit the insured, and the company needs to be able to draw lines between things that benefit third parties and that benefit the insureds, so that they can control the costs and the burden that they're going to pass along as far as premium on already cash-strapped employers in this state.
So I'd fall under or any other means of fertilization. That's what you're telling me.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. If you would summarize on your remedies.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. Mercy Care would ask that the court affirm the decision of the trial court in this case in the following respects. Number one, to find that de novo review applies in this particular case as to the interpretation of the statute. Number two, rejecting the statutory scheme theory that's discussed in the briefs and affirming the need to simply apply the three levels of deference. Number three, to confirm that 632.895 sub 7 permits the exclusion of expenses incurred by a woman who's acting as a surrogate mother. And number four, to confirm that the surrogate mother services exclusion in the 2002 certificate complies with that statute. And lastly, that the 2005 certificate complies with the addition of that comma. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I learned something this afternoon. I learned that in the 2005 certificate, the last phrase that reads, when the child will be parented by someone other than a woman who gives birth, I learned that now that is measured really not by whether the child will be parented, but whether the woman intends at the time of fertilization that the child will be parented by another. I suppose that Mercy Care can say that that's what the policy means now, but I think anybody looking at it will think that it says that it means what it says and refers to will be parented, meaning some actual fact of future parenting, whatever parenting might be, as opposed to a mere intention.
Are you suggesting that maybe a nanny is a parenting?
I'm sorry?
Are you suggesting that if I have a nanny for the child, that it would fall under that clause because the nanny is parenting the child?
I don't know. The concept of parenting isn't really defined in the in this. I assume that it relates to future acts of child raising. I don't know exactly how much that encompasses. I don't know whether any pregnant woman who was looking at the 2005 certificate would know whether whether she would be excluded from coverage because she intended to have a nanny, maybe intended at the time of fertilization to have a nanny, for all I know. I would like to talk with the court a bit about the deference question and about the commissioner's interpretation. Justice Rogensack, I agree with you that that second sentence in the statute is the troublesome one. It does seem that the first statute refers to people, and the second, or the first sentence refers to people, and the second one refers to services. And the question from Justice Prosser is, well, what is the extent of services that can be excluded? My opponent's suggestion that uniformity is the only limitation strikes me as fairly startling. That means that the covered services provision of a policy could say, what is covered? Every conceivable medically necessary service required to maintain your health and the health of your unborn child. Those are covered. Then, under non-covered services, it lists every conceivable medically necessary procedure that is necessary to protect the health of the life or the health of the mother and the child she's carrying, applies uniformly to every insured, whether they are employees, spouses, or dependent children. But what it does is negate coverage that is mandated in the first sentence. I think
what limitation would you put on it, Counselor?
I think that the limitations have to be, as the insurance commissioner indicated, specific procedures or occurrences that
they have to be enumerated. They can't be a generalized thing like surrogate mother services without saying what's in that package.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So it is just as the exclusions were identified: elective abortion, amniocentesis solely for the purpose of sex determination, service or pregnancy benefits delivered out of the service area. On the question of deference, I think. It is a question of institutional competence and experience. The insurance commissioner not only has been around for a long time, but has been around and has been required to interpret and to apply the mandatory coverage benefits statute since it came into effect in 1985. Although there are no decisions by the insurance commissioner specifically interpreting that statute, I think that it's a misstatement to say that the record is completely devoid of the commissioner's interpretation. For this, I need to start by offering an apology. As I was reading through the legislative history that's in the record, at pages 1208 through 13-something of the, I found the commissioner's fiscal note to the legislation that became the current 890 or 632.895. That fiscal note is contained on page 1250 of the record, and is consistent with the legislative council's sort of gloss on what the statute meant. And the insurance commissioner said that the statute amends 632.895 sub 7 to require every group disability policy, which provides maternity coverage to any individual, to provide the same level to persons, to the same level to all persons covered under the policy. I think That is the crux, that if any particular medical service is offered to any pregnant insured under the policy, it must be offered to all pregnant insureds under the policy. I think that is, you know, that is contemporaneous interpretation of the statute. It was made known to the legislature because it was in a fiscal note that went to the legislature when the legislation was pending, and is consistent with the legislative council's construction of that statute as well. I see that red light is on again, and if there are no further questions, thank you for your time.
Are there any further questions? Hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Olson. Thank you, Mr. Duchman, for your arguments today on an issue of statutory as well as policy interpretation and the level of deference owed to a statutory or policy interpretation of the Commissioner of Insurance. That concludes our hearing in 08AP2937. Mercy Care Insurance Company versus Wisconsin Commissioner of Insurance. It is now 2:45. The court will meet at 3:15 in the conference room. We are in recess until tomorrow. Our second batch of cases for the March calendar. We are in recess.